and welcome to Ahead of the Curve, the podcast from Acadia, where we dig deep into relevant topics around the world of derivatives and risk management and collateral. My name is Scott Sobolewski, co-head of Acadia's Quant Services Division, and today I'm joined by Dr. Roland Stamm, a partner in Acadia's Expert Services Group, and one of the founding partners and original authors of the Open Source Risk Engine. For listeners from previous podcasts, the Open Source Risk Engine powers the majority of what Acadia offers for our hosted risk services. And Roland brings also over 25 years of experience working with clients, primarily on a consulting basis, clients in Europe, the UK, and now more and more in Asia, we see, supporting clients who come to Acadia both for the uncleared margin rules and various model development and model validation projects around the edges of UMR, as well as bespoke internal model development and model validation requirements. So welcome, Roland.
Thanks, Scott. Great to be here.
I figured we'd start first about your career journey to Acadia, just to provide folks a bit more information about your background and your credentials here. Today, we'll eventually be talking about ISDA-SIM model validation. But given you have, I'd say, many more years by now, historically supporting, I'd say, more complex internal model development and validation initiatives at large banks, large investment banks, maybe you could sort of just give the listeners a flavor for some of that experience.
So my original trade is mathematics. And in 1999, I started in the banking industry in a relatively small bank, which went through a lot of different phases. It was split up. It was bought. It was going into default and had to be saved by the German government. Was split up again into multiple parts. And that was a very, very interesting journey over 14 years and gave me a lot of experience. I started in IT, basically programming reports and pricing functionality for the front office, then moving into the risk space, doing first mostly pricing, but then also risk modeling and becoming responsible for that in the organization. And after that very interesting and long journey, I decided to join some old colleagues of mine who had founded this very interesting consulting business called Quaternion in 2013. I joined them, and yeah, the rest is history. We started as a relatively small consulting firm, were then bought by Acadia in, what was it now, 2021?
Yeah.
After we had a very successful partnership on the services that you already mentioned, and then last year we became a part of the LSEC family.
Yeah. And we've we found a very happy home here in LSEC's Post-Trade Solutions Group. Those of you who are coming to this podcast probably know Acadia as the central industry utility for initial margin reconciliation, primarily within the non-cleared universe. The model, the industry model that's used to calculate that initial margin is the ISDA standard initial margin model, or ISDA-SIM for short. And compared to some of the more complex model development or model implementations that you've been a part of in your career, large potential future exposure implementations, very large-scale Monte Carlo risk factor evolution implementations, XVAs within the front office and risk. Maybe, Roland, you could just tell us a bit about why the SIM model is unique compared to some of those, you know, potentially more complex models, and what clients need to be aware of when they're looking to implement or validate ISDA-SIM locally.
So ISDA-SIM is unique in that it is a very prescriptive model. If you want, I wouldn't even call it a model as such, really, because
it formula.
Is a big formula. Exactly. That's what it is, right? It is coming or it is similar to regulation, FRTB SA, that is short for the Fundamental Review of the Trading Book Standard Approach, which is supposed to be the standard approach for calculating capital requirements for market risk. And so it's actually a bit simpler than that approach, but very similar in terms of the input factors that are required. And on the one hand, it takes away a lot of uncertainty, but you still have remaining uncertainty in that you have to obviously still calculate the input, which is NPVs and their changes as the market data changes. And of course, that depends on A, how you use market data, and B, how you calculate the NPV. And that is something that is, more diverging the more complex the product becomes. If you have a plain vanilla swap or an FX forward, something like that, probably most people would agree what comes out, at least with the same market data. Whereas when you have a TARF or other very exotic products, people will start to disagree even if they use the same market data, right? Because they use different model approaches.
Yep.
And that is always underlying these calculations. So in that sense, it's a very simple formula, yes, but with remaining uncertainty. And that's, I think, where a handy industry standard in even calculating those sensitivities is needed.
Yep.
and a good thing to have.
It does make the calculation and reconciliation of the margin amount easier. From our client's perspective, what they don't often realize up front, if they don't have much experience with model validations or pursuit of regulatory model approvals, at least for SIM, it's really, as you mentioned, much more about validation of the underlying pricing models producing those risk sensitivities. So one of the big points of communication that we'd like to come across in this podcast is the potential burden on clients to validate SIM. It's not just one model that you're validating. It depends very heavily on the diversity and the complexity of the underlying product types or instrument types within your UMR eligible portfolios. And yes, depending on those implementations and the product coverage, validating your SIM implementation or your model governance framework around SIM can require a validation of potentially dozens of individual models producing those risk sensitivities, not to mention, the SIM-specific validation requirements around backtesting and benchmarking. But yes, maybe before we get into those, based on, as you mentioned, some of your pre-2008, pre-crisis experience and your post-crisis experience, maybe you could just speak to the evolution, from your standpoint of model validation and model governance standards over that time frame, over your career, and particularly from the perspective of a regulated entity like a bank or a systemically important institution.
So I think the turning point in terms of model risk and awareness that model risk management is needed was really the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Even though before we also saw historically models breaking down. The best example, I think, is 1987. I think it was the Black Monday or Tuesday, I can't remember, where basically the market realized that black skulls with a standard volatility doesn't work and that a smile is required. That is where the smile emerged, kind of. And so that wasn't really until 2008, 2009, when regulators realized something is really amiss. I mean, there was one particular trade type, the CDO and CDO squareds, these kinds of things, which broke down entirely before everybody in the market had been using the same model, a single pricing parameter, basically the correlation to price them. And they realized, okay, this is completely wrong. And just saying it's industry standard was not enough anymore. So everybody realized we need something where people are really owning the model. Everybody who uses it has to own it. They have to show that they understand it and that they understand the breaking points as well.
And they can't just rely on vendor documentation.
I think
pre-2008, even large bank model validation functions, the model owner, could probably get away with just passing along the documentation as given them by the vendor. And now, as you mentioned, the regulatory pressures on demonstrating an ownership and a regurgitation or translation of any sort of even vendor model into the client's own understanding, that's a critical piece of the validation lifecycle.
Yeah. And one of the most prominent examples in the US for that kind of new awareness by the regulator is the SR 11.7 standard, which sets a pretty high bar to pass for model validation, where it says you not only need to understand the model, you have to do benchmarking, you have to do alternative model implementations to show that you are in a certain range, you have to explain why you are choosing this model and not another one, and so on and so on.
And not only benchmarking model outputs, but benchmarking and having demonstrated well. Quality controls around inputs like portfolio yes. data and, yes. and even more so the market yes. data, as you mentioned.
Exactly. You have to actually describe the entire processing from input data to output data, how the data is manipulated to get to the result, etc. Yes, that's
and that SR 11.7 documentation or regulatory guidance originated in the U.S., but we do see across our global client base it continued to be the gold standard, and being referred to by other regulators globally as the standard that they expect when they go and do any sort of regulatory approvals.
Yeah,
and for the majority of our clients. Acadia's hosted risk calculation service, the CRIF generation service, and our backtesting and benchmarking service for clients who have a regulatory requirement to have their initial margin model approved before use. We've had by now over 100 clients validate the Acadia hosted offering, and based on everything we just talked about for the last 10 minutes or so, validate the individual pricing models that Acadia is offering and the market data that Acadia is offering. Yes. But in their own language and their own internal documentation, and making sure that the input and output benchmarking, the qualitative methodologies that Acadia has chosen fit not only their model owner purpose, but pass an independent model validation from the client's perspective.
Yes.
So being part of those dozens and by now over 100 model validations, we know the types of questions and the types of issues or segments of relevant model owner or model validation documentation that many regulators in advanced jurisdictions would expect, particularly as it relates to the ISDA-SIM model and some of the underlying pricing models that yep. are producing those risk sensitivities. Yep.
A new example to that is the latest version of the so-called RTS, Regulatory Technical Standards, around initial margin validation. So the EBA, the European Banking Authority, has issued a draft for how to validate your initial margin model. It has recognized, okay, there are many, many financial markets participants who are exchanging initial margin. How are they doing it? What is the model behind this? And in the vein of SR 11.7 or similar regulations on other risk models, they want the users to own the models, to understand them, to inform their regulator how they do it and explain the details. And part of that is, an important part of that is backtesting.
Yep.
Even if you are only a small user, they distinguish now between smaller and larger participants.
I think phases 1 through 4 are in that large group, and then phases 5 and 6 generally
basically
are in that
smaller
group.
That's the split, exactly. And the smaller group will have fewer hoops to jump through, but there's still a backtesting effort that needs to be made in order to prove that you are using a model that is fit for its purpose for your particular portfolio. Yep.
And one tangible example, I believe that larger group is subject to two types of backtesting, a quarterly static backtesting that is based on hypothetical or risk theoretical P&Ls generated historically, in addition to dynamic backtesting where SIM is being compared against realized actual P&Ls. Whereas for that smaller group, they're only subject to one of those two types of backtesting, the dynamic
Correct.
Backtesting, I believe. So it does limit the model governance burden to some extent, though especially for banks that have their own internal model governance functions or certain other regulated entities, they'll still need to produce the documentation, at least initially, that codifies how the model operates, what sort of inputs are required, the process flows, the benchmarking, the quantitative benchmarking, which in our experience is where the majority of the effort lies. And even I think what a lot of our clients don't realize initially, especially if they don't have a lot of background with dealing with regulators for model approvals is they know they need to validate or receive approval for the ISDASIM model. It's actually the ISDASIM framework. So it's not just one model. It's not just one set of documentation. Even for probably the simplest portfolio we've seen where it's one or two product types, let's say it's one vanilla interest rate swap and European FX options, right? Two product types in total. That requires up to 9 or 10 distinct sets of documentation. From the model owner standpoint, one document each for the pricing models for those two products, mm-hmm. one model owner document for the ISDASIM model itself, and then generally another model owner document for the benchmark VAR model that's being used to compare against SIM on a daily or quarterly basis.
And all the backtesting framework.
Yeah, and generally, you know, that can include the P&L generation methodologies used in backtesting. So that's four right there, just from the model owner's perspective. Even for clients who are using Acadia's outsourced risk generation and backtesting services, they'll still need to produce those four documents themselves. Additionally, the same set of documents, but again, authored by an independent model validation group. Yep. So written more from an independent perspective that's based on the data consumed by those model submission documents. So that's eight documents right there. And generally, there's a third line, an internal audit function or an internal controls function that assesses that end-to-end SIM framework, usually on an annual basis, sometimes less frequently for smaller institutions. That document itself needs to be codified and reviewed by regulators more from a retrospective standpoint. And then lastly, some of our clients who are not banks, maybe they're larger buy-side firms. In the U.S., we have this concept of swap dealers or security-based swap dealers. It's a regulatory distinction for non-banks that are still systemically important in the derivatives market. For some of those clients, they're standing up a model governance framework or a model risk management framework for the very first time because their regulatory SIM approvals or their regulatory capital requirements. In the U.S., that stuff only went live in 2021, 2022. They're standing up an entire model governance framework for the very first time. So you need to have a governance document that outlines all of the requirements that the validation team would work towards, model scoring criteria, model tiering criteria, basically an entire framework that decides how these models should be validated internally. And again, that's unique to each individual institution.
Yep.
So hundreds of pages of documentation, even for very simple vanilla portfolios, and you can start to see how the documentation burden and the resource burden starts to increase exponentially as the number of different product types in scope for UMR grows. And we see clients sometimes with up to 50 different product types across all six asset classes. And those generally tend to be the larger investment banks. And you can start to understand very quickly why they have armies of hundreds of quants on standby to produce this documentation, not only for UMR or SIM purposes, but more broadly as well.
Yep.
So Roland, in my experience in the US, the question of regulatory approval for SIM is generally been answered for the majority of phase five and phase six clients. And we've supported clients on a consulting basis through our expert services group in those model validations and regulatory approvals. And the two big pieces of advice that I would give to clients who have not yet gone through that journey with their local regulator in places like Europe or the UK is to first be proactive, both in terms of timeline planning, even simpler implementations or simpler regulatory approval timelines can take up to 6 to 9 months. And more complex validation life cycles can be over a year, especially when setting up a lot of this documentation for the first time. So definitely try to not wait to the last minute for any looming regulatory deadlines. Regulators themselves are resource constrained like any other institution. And the second big piece of advice would be to be proactive in reaching out to your local regulator to declare your intentions for use of ISDASIM or a initial margin model. And there are generally not only queues or lines to get in, and the sooner you can get in that regulatory queue, the better. But Even more importantly, most regulators, in response to that outreach, will send, in the U.S., they would call them a first day letter, but essentially a set of formal regulatory requirements from your local regulator that is essentially your checklist or your shopping list to plan out your pursuit of that regulatory approval for ISDA-SIM. And I think we're all very curious, particularly in Europe, to know how the future will evolve for the EBA requirements in particular, and what some of those first day letters are starting to look like for maybe smaller entities of some larger institutions who are getting this outreach now very recently.
So we have seen some interest coming from smallish clients who have been approached by the EBA already and been told that they should do a validation by, let's say, end of next year. And as you say, Scott, I think it's very important that you take this seriously and that you work proactively on getting those targets online, right? So don't hesitate. And we're more than happy to help. As you say, we have done this exercise 100 times. We know what the regulators are looking for, what they're asking for. So if any of our listeners need help, we're more than happy to do that.
Not only the decades of experience from consultants like Roland and similar partners in other global regions here in Acadia, but you don't need to be a user or client of Acadia's from the hosted commercial services that I mentioned earlier. Even if you're using a competing vendor or a completely internal bespoke implementation to produce the risk sensitivities feeding SIM, we found Acadia can bring lots of synergies to a validation project, particularly on the benchmarking side, where we know we have a industry-leading service that has been already itself validated by over 100 clients, and we can very quickly and easily deploy the outputs of our service from our industry standard models as a quantitative benchmark against any sort of local deployment or alternative vendor deployment producing those CRIF sensitivities.
At this point, I'd like to point out that we also are sitting on a heap of very good market data, because part of our services is the SIM backtesting service, which, as we said before, is going to be an integral part of a validation exercise anyway. And actually getting clean, good historical market data is one of the biggest challenges in these validation exercises. So I just want to point out that we actually have that.
And I will, thanks for the plug, Roland, I will point out that we spent 25 minutes talking about exactly that on the market data front in exactly the previous Ahead of the Curve episode here. I'm assuming, depending on when that comes out, either the previous one or the one very following this episode. So definitely more information to learn about the market data question, which is a very big question for many of our clients, but a question that we've solved for at Acadia, at least for the hosted services clients. Yeah. So with that, Roland, is there anything else you'd like to add? I think our big message is just to be quite proactive in your outreach to your local regulator, your outreach to Acadia for potential assistance, and your internal resource planning. So that concludes today's episode of Ahead of the Curve. And for more information about Acadia's services or anything we spoke about today, we'll have more information at acadia.inc, or you can reach out to our general email at info@acadia.inc. And thank you guys very much for listening and joining us today. Thank you, Roland, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.